From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Happy Thanksgiving. Today we're going to listen back to three conversations about family on this most family-centric of holidays. We'll hear writer Casey Gerald talk about his rough upbringing, including the need to reconcile his faith with his sexuality. Gerald's book is called There Will Be No Miracles Here. We're also going to listen to my conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gregory Pardlow. He'll read from his memoir, Air Traffic, about his relationship with his father, who was an air traffic controller. But first, we'll hear Leonard Bernstein's daughter, Jamie. We spoke earlier this year about what it was like to have a famous father and to grow up Bernstein. That's all coming up when Radio Times continues after the news. Welcome to the Radio Times Thanksgiving special. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us today. We're going to begin our show about family by listening to my interview with Jamie Bernstein, daughter of the famous composer and conductor Leonard Bernstein. When she joined us in the studio earlier this year, she told us about her upbringing with a celebrity artist as a father, both how it affected their relationship and the effect it had on how she navigated the world. She wrote about all of this and more in her memoir, Famous Father Girl. Jamie Bernstein, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back.
Famous Father Girl. Where did that title come from?
I know. I kind of love this title because it's a little bit like a poke in the eye. Actually, that is what my second grade classmate, Lisa, used to call me to tease me, Famous Father Girl. And so I decided to use that for my title.
To own it yourself.
Yes.
Is it easier to be your father's daughter as a grown-up than as a child or a teenager?
Well, some things are definitely easier now. The book is really about the whole experience of growing up with this blinding light for a dad and to figure out how to make one's own light in, you know, when you're living in that overlit, sunlit environment. And it took a long time to sort it out, but it was there was also a lot of fun to be had along the way.
Well, I want to talk about all of that, but let me have you read a section, just a paragraph from your new book, your memoir.
Okay. It goes like this.
Okay.
In my mind's eye, my father is always in a scruffy brown wool bathrobe. My cheek still prickles at the memory of his scratchy morning hugs. He was frequently away on conducting tours, often for weeks at a time. We never felt we got enough of him. When he'd suddenly rematerialize at the front door, putting down his soft leather suitcase and squatting down to enfold us in his arms, Alexander, my brother, and I would tumble all over him like puppies, daddy, 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 mad with joy and hungry for the presents he'd brought us from those faraway lands. Mummy stood to the side, grinning, waiting her turn for the deep, tender kiss her husband would give her.
I love that paragraph, and we return to it really at the end of the book as well. There are many adjectives you use to describe your dad. One of them was exhausting. How would you describe how you saw your father growing up?
Well, you know, he was truly larger than life in every possible way. He wasn't just a musical genius, but he was also, as my mother used to say, a man with a motor. He was just going on all 16 cylinders all the time. He was a terrible insomniac. He literally could not shut off his motor. So he was up all night, and he just had all this energy. The rest of the world could hardly keep up with him.
Well, it seemed that he was a voracious person. I mean, voracious for life, voracious for music, for people.
Yes, he loved people, and he loved being surrounded by people. So that meant that he loved having the whole family together and all the friends, and he loved nothing more than to sit at the piano and have everybody all huddled around him, everybody, you know, screaming, bawling out songs at the top of their lungs. That was his idea of fun.
And a lot of competition, too, right? Word games and...
Yes, he was very competitive with with his kids just as much as with his friends and the rest of the family. You know, we played lots of word games and we played, you know, water volleyball and we played tennis. And so there was a lot of competitive spirit, but it was all with very good humor, really.
I thought it was interesting in that paragraph you read that you write, we never felt we got enough of him. Is that because he wasn't there so much of the time?
It wasn't just that he was away a lot, which he was. When he came home, he was really around, and he lavished attention on us three kids. So when we had him at home, we felt like we got plenty of him. But we had to share him with not only all the other people in his life, but the whole rest of the world. So there was that sense of it being very precious to have him just at home with us.
Did you resent that, having to share him with the rest of the world, including myself?
Well, I guess we would have resented it more had it not been for the fact that when he was with us, he was really with us. And he clearly enjoyed having us around. And I don't think we ever felt unwelcome in his presence. We were always allowed to interrupt him when he was working in his studio. We tried not to do that. But we often sort of barged in and asked him questions or had to show him something or would play with his little gadgets or anything like that. We never felt unwelcome. And he often invited us along when he was working. So if he had rehearsals, he would ask us to come along, or he invited us to go on the road with him when he toured, say, with the New York Philharmonic. And that was a ton of fun.
He was gay. And he was married, and he had children. And you write about this. You write about your parents' marriage and the sort of the complexities of relationships, obviously. And you also write about being a young person at Tanglewood and hearing rumors about your father and going to try to find out from your parents, was this true, was this not? What did this part of your life, what did that mean to you?
Well, this was a very difficult moment for me. I had just graduated from high school, so I was pretty young, and this was my first job out of high school, summer job at Tanglewood being a guide. And this is where I started hearing these rumors about my father's wild youth up there at Tanglewood when he was a student there. And he was still going up to Tanglewood every summer now as a teacher and conductor. And so that summer, I saw him up there, you know, it being the superstar that he was, and also hearing these rumors about his past. And this was all a lot for me to process as a 17-year-old. And as a 17-year-old, you're having trouble with your parents anyway. So I mentioned all of this in a letter to my dad. And my mother was the one who invited me home for the weekend when I had a day off just to have dinner and hang out. And then after dinner, my father took me for a little walk and talked to me about these rumors that I had told him about hearing. And he actually denied the rumors and said that, well, there were a lot of people in the world who were jealous of his success, and they would make up stories, and sometimes they even tried to blackmail him. And a lot of what he told me was true. But the part that wasn't so true was that the rumors were untrue. So it was very confusing for me, because eventually I came to understand that there was some substance to these rumors that I had heard, and I just had to piece it all together little by little on my own over the course of my college years.
Do you think he was protecting you, protecting himself, protecting...
My theory is that he was actually protecting my mother. My mother knew he was gay from the beginning. They went into their marriage with their eyes wide open and understood that what they were trying to do was going to be a challenge, but they really genuinely loved each other. And my siblings and I never doubted that for a second. It was completely evident, not just to us, but to the whole family and their friends and everyone who knew them, that they genuinely adored each other. So it was tricky, you know? But I think that whatever their arrangement was, it involved my father not bringing that side of his life into our family universe. And so when this little crack happened in the shape of their lives at home, I think my mother may have said, why don't you try and find a way to make everything continue as it was? That's my theory. I have no way of knowing what really went down between them.
Well, you do include a letter, actually, that your mother wrote to your dad. I think it was right before they got married, or they were very early married. She said to him, "You are a homosexual and may never change. I'm willing to accept you as you are without being a martyr and sacrificing myself on the LB altar." LB meaning, of course, Leonard Bernstein.
Right.
Altar. Those two sentences say so much.
Yes, they do. And we were astonished to read this letter quite recently because it had been sealed by my father's manager, Harry Kraut. And then we unsealed it, my brother and sister and I, just maybe in the last, over the last 10 years at some point. And then we gave it and various other unsealed documents to the Library of Congress to join the rest of the archives. And my general feeling about sensitive subjects like this is that if you try to suppress them, they're just going to find a way to come back around and bite you in the butt. That's always my feeling about these things. And I think it's better to be honest and to just put it out there in the context of love and caring. And then this is what I attempt to do in my book, is to talk about these issues in the context of how we basically all loved each other and found a way to get through it.
Well, that's why I think it's so important. And I think to think that relationships and families are not complicated, that people don't have secrets or demons and can still care for each other. And it was clear, I mean, your mother died in her 50s, and it seems your dad, you know, wanted to nurture her and take care of her.
Well, he tried as best he could in this terrible last year of her life where she was very sick with cancer. And it was just a tough patch there, because there was a moment when my father left my mother for this man in 1976. And he couldn't really sustain that life. So he came back to my mother in 1977, and the family was so relieved, but my mother was coughing a lot. And then 1 year after that, she was dead.
Wow.
So that was three tough years in a row, actually.
You describe her as the family policeman and Lenny stabilizer, your mom.
She was definitely a Lenny stabilizer, which was not the world's most wonderful job, I can assure you. But she did give us this incredibly stable, gracious, warm, lovely home environment to grow up in. And it was great for my dad because he was such a all-over-the-place kind of a guy. And he really thrived by having this home life that really had a reliable shape and reliable warmth. And that was great for him. So after our mother died, it was really tough for him not to have that anymore. He kind of flew off the handle in many ways.
That was my interview with Jamie Bernstein about her book Famous Father Girl, recorded in June this year. When we get back from the break, we'll listen to my conversation with poet Gregory Pardlow about his father, who was an air traffic controller, and his life was upended when he was fired for striking. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Radio Times Thanksgiving special on families. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Up next, we're going to hear from Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gregory Pardlow. When he joined us earlier this year, he had just released a memoir called Air Traffic. The book is a character study of his once exuberant father, whose life was upended when he was fired for striking as an airport employee. Pardlo also discusses the effect his father's experience and behavior had on his own life, which included serious bouts of alcoholism. Let's take a listen. Your book is largely, but not exclusively, about your relationship with your father, but it's dedicated to your mother, Stretch. Where did she get the name Stretch?
My father gave her that name. It was because she was tall, and he was the only person I ever heard call her Stretch, and you know that was his pet name for her.
Your dad died a few years ago. Did he see this manuscript, or how much of this manuscript did he see?
No, he didn't see the manuscript at all. He knew that I had sold the book. And obviously he knew that I was working on the book because he and I had many conversations together over the last couple of years of his life. But even if the manuscript had been completed before he died, I doubt he would have taken the time to read it. He would have taken my word for it. Yeah, sure. It's great. Okay.
That tells us something about you and your father,
right.
Does it not?
Yeah. Yeah.
You also write about your mother, being the brains in the family. How so?
So my dad was the personality. He was the front man. But my mother was always quietly keeping it together. She was the one making sure that we got to our lesson. My brother and I got to our lessons or obviously to school. She was the one fighting the fights and putting out the fires at home. So I wanted to make sure that readers understood that none of this would have been possible without her rock steady presence and determination.
Well, I don't want to make too much of this, but at the same time, I do think, broadly speaking, with some exceptions, that firstborn sons, which you were, and namesake, which you are, that the relationship, even in the most functional families, the relationship between a father and son like that is both burdened and has responsibility and has specialness as well. I think moms are often taken for granted, kind of a given, as you said, took care of all the sort of logistics of family life. Mm-hmm. But fathers and sons, there is something so powerful there.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also the case that because my father was such an outspoken and egotistical person, a kind of not that I'm an astrological thinker, but he was a typical Leo, right? He was very...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so I speculate, and I confidently speculate, that he saw me as an extension of himself, as someone to be proud of, but as a product of his work. And so whenever I seem to be... making an effort or striving to express myself on my own terms, I think he was threatened by that, and he would tend to, you know, try to put me back in my place.
Mm. Jealous, competitive. I mean, it felt like some.
I think all of
degree
that.
Of that.
I think all of that. Yeah, yeah. He wouldn't admit to either of those, but there's no other explanation for it.
And it seems that. Even you describe parties where he was a backyard barbecue and someone said something that I think was about a plane going overhead.
Right,
and he
right.
said, no, it's going south and not north. He had to be right.
He had to be right. He had to be respected. He wanted to be admired. He wanted his intelligence to be recognized, and so for all these things to take place, he had to be performing constantly. He had to be on stage, so it was tiring to have to feed that fire constantly. As his son and namesake, right? Yeah.
As a reader, and this is always true with memoirs, how do you want us to view your father? Because there were times, I have to say, I was really angry at him. Because I felt like he was stealing your thunder.
Well, yeah, yeah. And I didn't want, when I started writing the book, the one thing I was sure of was that neither was I going to make him a kind of clean, clear-cut hero. But I didn't want to villainize him either. So I want readers to see a complicated man who, through it all, was nonetheless lovable and a dedicated and good friend. He has lots of friends from, you know, people actually, as I go around with the book, I'm meeting more and more people who say, I knew your dad. Mm-hmm. He was such a great guy. What an amazing person. But beneath all of that, there's a reality. And I want readers to identify with or to understand and sympathize with the fact that there are deep human currents beneath all of us that are motivating the quirks and idiosyncrasies and both positive and negative that we all have.
What's so interesting, he went to Germantown High School here in Philadelphia. He was the head of the Black Student Union at the high school, apparently interviewed here at WHYY in the 1960s. And he gave a speech at a school board meeting. He was known for a man who could really use language in a really powerful way.
Extemporaneously.
Yeah, and without a script, right?
Yeah, yeah. He would never, and that was one of his mantras, was, you know, that I don't prepare. You know, to prepare is to cheat somehow. And I could never think like that, and it, you know, provided or presented a high level, a high bar for me to reach. And it was really intimidating for a long time. But yeah, he prided himself on his ability to show up and perform and dazzle.
And dazzle. And clearly there are some little snippets of things that he said, and they are dazzling.
Which I heard many times over the years growing up. So some of it is recreated, but many of the lines and images are verbatim.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section, and this gets you to second grade. You were having, as you describe, some behavioral problems. Your mom devised a really interesting way of trying to monitor your behavior. There was the good rock and the bad rock, and whichever rock you brought home.
It was one rock, actually. So I would either come home with the rock or I wouldn't come home with the rock.
And if you didn't come home with the rock,
that was a bad day.
That was a bad day.
There would be consequences, yes.
Well, let's read this section about your dad and his consequences.
My father devised punishments that were cunning and proud. He dropped the family dictionary like a Christmas ham on my rickety desk and gave me, with nothing more to go on than the mere attire of its pronunciation, an unfamiliar word. Disconsolate, for example. He would enunciate the word with the monotone of a spelling bee announcer. I had to find the definition of the word and then find, in that definition, another word I did not understand. I was then to look up that subsequent word and so on until I could prove to my father's satisfaction that I understood every word in the definition clearly, verifying the lexical descent from my original word, at which point he might or might not assign me a new word. The ordeal couldn't have lasted more than half an hour each time, but as I remember it, I spent entire evenings at my desk heaving pages the size of car mats. As a result of this experience, for years to come, indeed in perpetuity, my father's vocabulary words continue to occur to me with a hint of irony, announcing their status in italics.
And the word perpetuity is in italics. That was one of his words.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I can imagine, as you describe as a second grader, that seems pretty onerous.
That's right, yeah.
But as a poet, did that help?
Absolutely. Kind of- so what I... It turned out to be fun for me because this was one of the few opportunities I had to engage with my father. And so I think over the years, the dictionary became a conduit to my dad's world, kind of representative of his interior life. And so I have a fond relationship with the dictionary rather than the onerous one we would expect. Yeah.
Well, your dad was commuting to Newark because he worked as an air traffic controller at Newark Airport.
That's right.
This is a stressful job, as you describe. In fact, you write that most air traffic controllers at this time never made it to retirement because of the stress.
Yeah, yeah. So because of a number of reasons, as we can imagine, the personal reasons of alcoholism and, you know, substance abuse, the psychological damage of the pressure from the job. I mean, it's a difficult job to get into, and then a difficult job to stay in. And And so the strike was really asking to just acknowledge that difficulty on a very fundamental level. And if you're not in it, as we see from a lot of the response to the strike, the public at large just wasn't aware of how stressful, how damaging that the lifestyle of being an air traffic controller had been.
Was that, I mean, perhaps looking back on your childhood, did you see the stress on your own dad?
Yeah. I didn't know it then.
Right.
But in retrospect, I'm very aware that his short patience and his antisocial behavior. So he would come home and sort of either lock himself in his room, or he didn't want to talk. I attribute that very much to the stress of having to keep thousands of people safe all day long.
You include a letter that Ronald Reagan wrote to the head of PATCO here, saying to him, and this was October 20th, 1980, "You can rest assured that if I'm elected president, I'll take whatever steps are necessary to provide our air traffic controllers with the most modern equipment available and to adjust staff levels and work days so they are commensurate with achieving a maximum degree of public safety."
It's fascinating how that letter, how the demands of the strike mirror almost precisely what Ronald Reagan recognized before taking office, but before the election even. So this was a campaign letter, promise of his. And they were asking just basically exactly what Reagan lists in that letter.
And he fired, this was 1981, so he became president and fired, what, 13,000?
Close to 13,000, yeah. So, but the number is, I've found differing numbers because some went back right away and, different circumstances,
You describe being a little boy on the picket line. I mean, it sounds like as you say, it didn't really keep anyone away from the airport, but nonetheless, there were these
protests.
There was
a symbolic picket line, right, which was along the highway. Whenever I drive on Routes 1 and 9 behind the airport, I try and figure out, was that where we were? Mm-hmm. Is that where we were? But what I remember very vividly were cars driving by, flipping us the bird, shouting, you know, "Go back to work, you lazy so-and-so." And people, somebody actually throwing food at us as they went by.
Wow.
And it was just so confusing to me. Of course, on the inside, I was aware of how difficult and all the work was and how reasonable the demands were. But on the outside, the public perception was entirely different. Mm-hmm. And that took me a long time to understand and see what the particular failures of the strike were in that regard.
Your dad was one of the thousands that did not go back to work.
Back.
So he basically, he lost his job. He was blackballed.
Job, pension, health care, everything.
Was gone.
Was gone overnight. Mm-hmm.
And this was, and Ronald Reagan, as I understand it, also said that all these PATCO workers could never work
in government again
as a reason, because of the, he was truly punishing them.
Yeah, he was making a point. In 93, I believe, don't quote me on the date, but President Clinton lifted the ban.
Yeah.
But by then, you know, work conditions had changed. The equipment finally had changed, as according to the demands of the strike, ironically. And it was difficult at best for my father at that point to go back.
What was the effect of the strike? Or I guess not just the strike, but also being fired and never getting his job back. What effect on your dad?
Well, his ego, primarily.
Because he was a proud man.
He was a very proud man. He was a labor leader. He relished the spotlight. And in a way, he kind of backed himself into a corner because I don't think he would have gone back in any circumstances. But because he was so public about his involvement in the strike, symbolically, he could not possibly have gone back.
Oh.
Right. And so his integrity was wrapped up in that. And more than the practical impact was obvious, right? Financially, we were destitute overnight, as I say. But the more long-term impact was to his sense of identity, his sense of his pride, his ability to provide for the family, right? All of that stuff gets damaged, and it's like having a corrupt file in a computer program. You know, it's just it looks the same. It kind of operates the same, but he wasn't the same.
Manhood, right? I mean, that's part of your subtitle.
Right, and this is the manhood part of it, right? And then the impact on me, right, is trying to figure out, as a kid, I don't have the resources to see how the strike, you know, operates, how it undermines his sense of himself, and how it requires him to reinvent himself. So, you know, I saw this guy who was just he couldn't get a leg up. You know, the world just kept kicking him down, and you know, the story that I create in my head is, man, life's hard. You can't trust anybody. Don't invest in any long-term plans and any companies or communities even. But as an adult, you know, looking back and trying to figure out for myself, trying to separate what my father was responsible for and what the world, the circumstances were responsible mm-hmm. for, I could see how his just character flaws and the positive parts of him as well contributed to the circumstances that kept him sort of falling down the rung every time he climbed up one. Mm-hmm. My father's, on the one hand, it's great to hear how people have recovered in various ways from the strike. But on the other hand, in a very selfish way, it also reminds me of how my father did not recover, the ways in which he failed to recover, and just highlights all the more how the kinds of personal challenges that he faced that made it difficult for him to just resume the kind of triumphant lifestyle he saw himself having from the outset.
That was my interview with poet Gregory Pardlow about his memoir, Air Traffic, recorded in April. When the Radio Times Thanksgiving special comes back after the break, we'll hear about the rough upbringing and eventual triumph of writer and entrepreneur Casey Gerald. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Radio Times Thanksgiving special. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks again for joining us today. We're going to close out today's series of discussions about family with Casey Gerald. He grew up in a poor and dysfunctional family in suburban Dallas. His complicated relationship with his parents was just one of the obstacles the young Gerald had to overcome. He also had to reconcile his homosexuality with his religious upbringing. And even though he would become a success story, Gerald's past still informs his perspective on the crushing nature of poverty in this country. He writes about all of this in his book, There Will Be No Miracles Here. You write in great detail and in many ways with a lot of love about your parents. Your mm-hmm. father was a really talented football player, mm-hmm. a quarterback. Mm-hmm. He got injured, and in certain ways it seems as if back in those days, you give people drugs, you put them back on the field. That created problems for him.
Yeah. I remember when I was in sixth grade, I walked into class and my teacher handed me a copy of the Dallas Morning News. And my father was on the front cover. It says, "Once the pride of Texas, South Oak Cliff star, threw away his life for drugs." Mm. I said, "Oh, man, that's a really bad dude, you know." Well, it just so happened, as I was researching this book, I found that the story was more complicated. My father is still considered by many to be one of the greatest high school football players in the history of the state of Texas. He went on.
Which is saying something.
Which is saying something.
Because we know about football
Absolutely.
In Texas.
Absolutely. I mean, I know we're in Philadelphia. I don't want to,
You don't want to
run
up
down.
Our fans
yeah, I don't
here,
want to be
right?
run down when I come out of the studio. But he goes off to Ohio State. He second black quarterback in the history of the program, played for Woody Hayes. His sophomore year, he breaks his back in a game against Purdue. Later that season, Ohio State makes it to the Orange Bowl. Woody wants him to play. He wants to play. He's not totally healed. Before the game, somebody comes and says, "You want me to give you something to make you play like a champion?" He gives him an envelope with cocaine in it.
Wow.
He takes it. He's MVP of the Orange Bowl, has the game of his life. He never plays a game without using. And things spiral from there. So one of the big things I was trying to do with this book is to trouble the villain-hero narratives, the flat narratives that we get, whether it's about, you know, folks who are drug addicts or, you know, folks who are president.
He called you Scooter.
Scooter, yeah, which I still don't understand, which I still rather like, actually.
I do, too.
Yeah,
it feels kind of old-fashioned in a way to for a dad to call his son Scooter. You also write about your mom, and as you said, she was, or perhaps still is, bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a time when you were young, 12, maybe 13, mm-hmm. where she just disappeared. I mean, she said, "I'll be back." And then she disappeared.
Yeah. She disappeared, I thought, when I was 12. And this gets to what I'm saying about how vital it is to trace the cracks, whether you're talking about a life or a country. I thought most of my life she disappeared when I was 12. Then I started researching the book, and it turns out she disappeared when I was 13. She was around for a whole year after I had internalized her being gone. And that says something very real to me about how little we actually understand the most important things that happened to us. But I had to take a step further, because this was the worst thing that ever happened to me. You know, my mother was my best friend, and she just disappeared one day. I just assumed she was dead. To fill in the plot, she sort of reappeared 5 years later out of the blue when I was 18. But I was so angry, and I was so hurt, and so many early drafts of that material were just like, "I hate you, I hate you, I hate you." That has no literary value, of course. But I was able to get on the other side and see my mother as a human being, not just as my employee. And when I did,
as your employee, as
you
her
see,
son.
You see what I'm saying?
I do.
And when I did that, I was able to see that the worst thing that ever happened to me was perhaps the most important thing she ever did for herself.
Do you think she was running for her life in a way?
Oh, without question. I mean, listen, I saw a few days ago that suicide is the second leading cause of death for young people in this country. I mean, that shouldn't surprise anyone. I mean, we've heard it over and over again. The failure in this society to actually support people who are at base having a hard time and more specifically are dealing with serious mental illness is, I think, a scandal. And I saw it 20 years ago, you know, going to the psychiatric hospitals with my mother.
Yeah, where she was hospitalized.
Sure.
But what the thing, I guess, since you put your family out there, we as readers, we get to have our opinions or even judge, is that when she disappeared, nothing was said. When she came back, nothing was said. And I'm just trying to imagine being a young boy, very close to your mother, and there's no explanation that could help, it seems to me, a young person understand what might have been going on.
Sure. This book, and hopefully my life, is not just a memoir. It is an intervention. You see, I'll give you an example. When I was writing it, my mother started disappearing again. Okay.
Really?
And
more recently then.
Yeah. And my niece was 12 at the time.
Oh, wow.
And
that would be your sister's child.
My sister's child, yeah. And as heartbreaking as it was to see her go through the same things that I had gone through at that very age, and to see these responses that people say, "Oh, Kendall's checking on folks. She's such a sweet kid." And I say, "No, actually, that is very alarming that she's afraid that everybody is like disappearing all of a sudden. So she's checking on you for those reasons." So as heartbreaking as that was, it actually was a great gift as it pertained to the book, because it set the standard. If there's not something in this book that can help my niece feel that she's not alone, feel that she can understand the trauma that she's experiencing, feel that she can get on the other side of it, and not just my niece, but all these other young people who are going through these awful experiences, then what is the book worth, you see? And so that was a very hard but very helpful in some ways experience to go through as I was writing.
We're up on a break here, but it's interesting that, you know, you talk about 1999, December 31st, as a kind of a way to disappear from the planet,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, if the rapture
sure.
were to come, and then, of course, having to actually live with your mom disappearing on
yeah,
you.
Yeah. I tell people, I say, I didn't want the world to end. I write this in the book. I want it to be rescued.
Right.
Yeah.
Very different.
Don't we all?
I do want to go back to your grandfather, who had this mega church in, was it in Dallas or
mm-hmm.
was it, in,
mm-hmm.
in Dallas itself? You write, when he was in the greatest business in America, saving souls. But this was one of those mega churches that we think of as thousands of people coming to church?
Well, it was not quite that yet. You talk about a life. His grandmother had been born a slave. He was raised in a little dirt floor house in Dawson, Texas. Starts preaching at 16, making canned goods. This was his compensation.
Oh, wow.
He got to Dallas and joined a church preaching and then founded his own church. And he and my grandmother were the first black people to integrate Oak Cliff, my neighborhood in Dallas. And they were moved in. They were egged. They were, called niggas as they walked down the street. You see what I'm saying?
I do.
It was a very dangerous experience. And so that church was not just a religious exercise. It was a safe space and in many ways a cornerstone for people who were coming in trying to find some way to be in the world that was very hostile to them. I have to tell this story because it's been on my heart so much.
Go ahead.
And this is people are leaving in my generation the church, and very rightfully so, and hopefully we talk about that. But this is what's so beautiful about the role of the black church, especially in the South and perhaps in other places in the country historically. A cousin of mine, Rhoda Faye, always was having a horrible time. I mean, didn't have any money, didn't have a job, and all this kind of stuff. And people say, oh, Rhoda Faye is a mess, y'all, whatever. And that might be true for 364 days of the year. And then Easter Sunday came.
Oh.
And Rhoda Faye would recite every Easter the Crucifixion by James Weldon Johnson. And she'd get up, and every year she'd have the same tired hat with the, dirt on the inside and all this kind of stuff. And the same little, cubic zirconia rings and all this kind of stuff. Say, oh, here's Rhoda Faye coming again. And she'd stand up and she'd hold her head up high and she'd say, I will now recite the Crucifixion by James Weldon Johnson. Here is a society that for almost 400 years has tried to destroy these people. And that might work for 364 days of the year, but here was this one day in the church where she could stand up and she could recite the Crucifixion by James Weldon Johnson and be the greatest person on the planet. I mean, it was incredible.
Yeah, and people, I'm assuming, expecting it every year.
Oh,
and,
man, waiting just, for it.
Yeah,
you
waiting
know what
for
I mean?
It. Exactly.
You know, it was an event.
Right.
And so, people have talked about this book as being sort of hard to categorize. It's so political, it's so spiritual, it's so personal. I mean, so is life. And I think the job of literature ought to be to bring the real expression to the human experience, not to just prove a lot of words.
Well, help us understand then your relationship to the church, even as a child growing up. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there were sermons or readings about homosexuality being a sin. How did you understand that or even grapple with it as a young person or maybe even now?
Mm-hmm. I had to let go of the God I was given to find the God I needed. And in a lot of ways, the greatest gift on that journey was being a homosexual because there was no reconciling. My uncle died of AIDS in 1994, my grandfather's son, and to see, so did three or four other of our choir members, and to see how they were, I was 7 or 8 at the time, to see how they were discarded and dehumanized before I even had any understanding of my sexuality. So I spent so much of my youth trying to get rid of this gift, trying to ignore it, trying to pray it away. You know, I'd call the Trinity Broadcasting Network and say, "Will y'all pray for me to be delivered?"
I was Did you to, really? You
oh,
call
sure.
into the?
Sure. Yeah, 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 yeah. They were very nice people.
Didn't work, apparently.
No, thankfully it didn't. But this took such a toll on me that at some point I didn't want to be alive, you see. And so many queer young people in our society have reached that point where they just can't see any other way than to get out of here. Well, when I reached that point, I figured I'm not going to die in this life to avoid hell in the next. I'm not going to mutilate myself for God's love. Now, initially, I took on kind of the stance of a spurned lover, you know what I mean? To hell with him, you know, he ain't nothing, you know, I don't need him, that kind of thing. And that lasted for a while, and then I got so low, and I reached this point in my life where I didn't know what to do or where to turn. And at that moment, something grabbed me, you see. And I called that something God. But a friend sent me a sermon, and the minister said, if you really want to know God, the best way is to assume you know nothing about God. And that's where I am, Marty, you see. I am every day trying to build a relationship with this mystery, with this stranger that is more real and more important to me than any other thing in my life.
God more than the church?
The church is dead. I mean, let's be very clear. And it should have been dead a long time ago. I mean, if Jesus Christ himself, I mean, little poor, crazy Jesus of Nazareth, I'm not talking about Jesus Christ, the totem pole, came back and walked into a church, he'd be apoplectic. I mean, he'd probably just faint. He'd die all over again. I mean, it's nuts. So I think so many of my friends and my peers had to, whether they were queer or not, had to find something else other than this church thing that we were given. Right. But that does not mean that we've forfeited our spiritual life.
You're right. And again, this is about your family. And I'm quoting here, we pretended that we were not a group of people who had destroyed each other. This was after your mother had come back to the family. Is that how you feel about them today? Or is that something you had to, in a sense, go through to be able to understand your family from their perspective?
Do I still feel that we were a group of people that had destroyed each other?
Yeah. Families can do that.
Sure, yeah. I'd imagine most of the 300-some million Americans feel that way, and probably most of the 7 billion people.
I'm sitting here nodding my head.
You know what I mean?
Yep, yep.
You know, so,
but some families are harder than others.
Sure. And that does not mean that there's not love there. And that does not mean that we're throwing them overboard. You know, one of the things that this book taught me was that we are all happened to and happening on other people. And some of it is just trying to understand, well, you know, where does one begin and where does the other end, you see? So, yeah, I still feel that way, but it's not a feeling of bitterness. It's just trying to tell the truth.
Right. Mm-hmm. Has your family read your memoir? I mean, do they recognize the family that you have written about? And I don't think any family who has a family member write a memoir, they would write a different book, I'm assuming. But what do they think about the book that you've written?
Well, it sort of goes back to this I-we thing. It depends on who you're talking about. Mm-hmm. My mother and grandmother, I mean, I have all women in my family. I just love it. My mother read an article about the book. She hadn't even read the book yet. And so if her response to the articles are any indication, then if she ever reads the book, this might be sort of a replayed interview as a memorial for me, you know,
really?
Kind of thing. And she went on and she said, and she really had a kind of big meltdown. She said, I can't believe, you know, why is he saying that I abandoned him? This is so not true. And this is, oh, it's breaking my heart. And my grandmother, her mother, says, oh, Deborah, come on. She says, hey, I'm glad he wrote it, because I know he has been holding in a lot for a long time.
Wow.
And I'm so glad he finally got it out. And if he got some more, let him write another one, you know. So I don't want to broadly categorize any group of people. There between my mother and my grandmother is a great microcosm of response.
With a lot in between there. That was my interview with writer and entrepreneur Casey Gerald about his book, There Will Be No Miracles Here, recorded in October. And that wraps up the Thanksgiving edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, Alex Stern, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thanks for joining us, and have a great Thanksgiving.